Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
On an island off the coast of Scotland, something was summoned from the depths of hell. Something that would end mankind.
And this thing you worried about, did it show up?
Oh, yes. You did.
We face every threat there is, and yet you take me.
Hey guys, welcome to A New Winter, Cults and Culture, and today we're going to be comparing the 2004 version of Hellboy against the 2019 version of Hellboy. The 2004 one was done by Guillermo del Toro. The 2019 one was by Neil Marshall. So if you haven't seen the latest Hellboy and you want to wait to see it before you hear anything about it, then you may want to do that now, because we're going to go deep into spoiler territory. But I'm going to be honest, there's not much to actually spoil. So I wouldn't worry too much if you haven't seen the film, because, spoiler, right from the off, it's not that good. So I thought we'd start with the latest Hellboy anyway. And yeah, because it was deemed a flop. If you don't know already, absolutely panned by critics. And I can kind of see why. I mean, Neil Marshall directed it, who I always associate with the fantastic film, to be honest, The Descent, if any of you have seen that. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend that you go and watch it. Before that, he did Dog Soldiers, which some liked. I didn't really think it was that great, but I kind of liked what it was about. From The Descent, that kind of raised his profile in the States, and he went on to making a string of rather lackluster films, to be honest, including Doomsday, Centurion, and then he went into TV and directed the infamous Blackwater episode of Game of Thrones, and he did an episode here and there for shows like Black Sails, Constantine, Hannibal, Westworld. So doing Hellboy was, you know, quite a big one for him. It's essentially his kind of return into cinema, and to be honest, it's not really a good one. So it stars David Harbour as Hellboy. He's known for his role as Hopper in Stranger Things, and it's got Mila Jovovich, I don't really know how to say her name, I'm afraid, as the evil Blood Queen. Ian McShane, or Lovejoy, as I like to think of him as, is Hellboy's dad, essentially, the leader of this paranormal bureau thing. Daniel Day Kim, who's from Lost, is in it. And also the voice of Stephen Graham, who's in This Is England, etc., etc. So what actually happens? Well, let's get into the plot. We get a little scene right from the beginning where we're told that King Arthur and Merlin have destroyed this Blood Queen who cast a plague over England. Arthur used Excalibur to chop her into pieces and then sent her parts all over the country. And we cut to present day. Hellboy is going to this wrestling match where there's some... And on his way, there's this really unnatural dialogue, just full of exposition that's just blah. And it's talking about finding this missing agent that he knows. So this agent is now a wrestler, who is also now a vampire. Apparently he was looking into vampires down in Mexico or something. And he's been taken over by them. So gets into a fight with Hellboy in the wrestling ring and somehow gets impaled. just immediately just kind of sums up how stupid this film really is. He gets impaled on one of those, you know, basically the corner posts that they have in wrestling rings. So very blunt, usually padded, and somehow he gets impaled on it. But okay, fine. And then his, like, this guy's last dying words is something about the end is coming. So there's something apocalyptic happening. So, I mean, I should say, you know, as this is kind of the intro scene for this new Hellboy, Harbour's actually a really good Hellboy, I think. Personally, and I'll kind of go into this a bit later, I don't think he's quite up there with Ron Perlman, but he's okay. I just quite like the way he looks, and he's quite deep-set eyes. He looks a bit more, like, intimidating, maybe. His colour is kind of verging on a really neon red, which I'm not 100% about, but yeah, and also we get a lot of CG in this intro scene, and this is one of the biggest, well, this is one of my biggest bugbears anyway, is that the CG in this film is absolutely awful. I mean, it literally looks like something from the early noughties, which is ironic, keeping in mind we're about to talk about the 2004 Hellboy, and, you know, it has CG in that. But yeah, here, it's 2019, it just looks terrible. So we meet Ian McShane as Hellboy's father, and he's really, like, dialing it in. It looks like he can't be bothered, basically. Then there's this weird scene where he's helping Hellboy shave his horns, and it just looks so fake. And it's just completely, again, just unnatural dialogue. And it's also weird because Ian McShane, he doesn't exactly look that much older than Hellboy. So it's tough to see him as this kind of father figure anyway, because they look about the same age. Also because he's like, Ian McShane's character is just a complete twat to him. Supposed to be, like, their relationship is supposed to be this emotional hook throughout the film. But yeah, they're just both as bad as each other. They both act like children. They both don't communicate with one another. And, you know, Ian McShane's character, the dad, isn't this father figure who, you know, tries and he makes mistakes. He just has no redeeming qualities whatsoever. So it's hard to root for their relationship because you don't really understand it or like it, to be honest. You're not rooting for anyone. You feel Hellboy gets angry, not being like a teenage rebellion against his father kind of thing, but just through sheer frustration with his dad's character. It's, you know, I'd probably be acting like that as well, whether or not he's my dad or a boss. It's ridiculous. So Hellboy is told that this ancient club of some sort need Hellboy's help to hunt some giants before they reach highly populated areas. So Hellboy goes to the Osiris Club, I believe it's called, finds out that his dad was once with them, anyway, part of this club, and that actually he was supposed to kill Hellboy when he was born into this world, but didn't. And we learn that through this Lady Hatton, this blind seer. There's an awful flashback scene where we see Nazis raise Hellboy in what looks like something from a lower low, to be honest. It looks so awful. And the seer comes in with Ian McShane in a, like they're a married couple or something. It's very strange. And Thomas Hayden Church is there, okay, this is another new character. But he's just some random guy who I'm guessing is in the comics that kills a bunch of Nazis, and we never see him again. It's a waste, really. I don't know. The scene doesn't really tell us anything, but Hellboy seems to, like, be upset with his dad for never telling him that he was supposed to kill him, and he's angry with him for letting him live or something. I don't really understand why he's getting so angry about it. It's like, oh, you should have told me. It's like, yeah, well, do you want to know that? You know, his dad was supposed to kill him and didn't. Like, is that something? Why are you angry with him about that? And also, I remember that there was a whole interview with the guy who wrote Hellboy, who was saying that this film isn't about the origins of Hellboy, because we've kind of had that. And it's like, oh, okay. And then we've got this origin scene, which is by far and away much worse than the 2004 version. So, whatever. So we find out where Hellboy came from, I guess, in some weird way. But while all this is happening and he's having this talk, this pig creature thing goes to some witch to get revenge on Hellboy. And the witch tells him to put back the pieces of the Blood Queen together, stitch them together so that she can give him the power so he can get his revenge, right? So that's kind of it's not even a B plot, it's the main plot, but that's kind of happening. That's there. So more new characters, by the way. So then Hellboy goes out with these Osiris Club guys You know, they ride around on a horse with him. They look at the damage the giants have done. They're, you know, getting nearer and nearer. And then they decide to try and kill Hellboy. Now, there's so much wrong to this that it's hard to kind of know where to begin. So firstly, they say how three giants is no big deal, which is contradictory to what they said earlier, where they're saying, you know, when they tricked him, because they were like, oh, we can't handle three. So then they're like, huh, you can't think we can't even handle three. And it's like, well, the dad was part of the group, right? So when they asked him to help, wouldn't he have thought, oh, three shouldn't be such a big deal? This sounds a bit dodgy. But okay, let's say he got tricked into it as well. Fine. And yeah, why? So why would they lead him towards the giants? Why not just take him anywhere in any open space? It doesn't really matter, because the problem is that the giants kill them, and that's how Hellboy kind of escapes. So, you know, if it wasn't for the giants being around, they would have actually killed Hellboy, which I think was the whole point anyway, to stop this weird apocalypse. So, but yeah, so they die. So I guess three was too much anyway, wasn't it? They say, oh yeah, we can handle three. And they obviously can't, because they got killed. And yeah, also if they're really, you know, if you really got to kill these giants, if that's part of the thing, why not get Hellboy to help them? And then kill him after that. And at least, and then he'll be, like, weaker, if anything. I just don't get it. So, yeah, Hellboy wakes up, takes on the giants and kills them before passing out whilst this kid takes him home. I don't know how she's managed to move him, but still. So we're introduced to another new character. He's called Alice, who's a medium. And she's probably the worst actress I've ever seen. So how can they find someone so bland and also so posh that lives in a council estate? So this Alice is this baby that Hellboy saved, that the pig thing that we've seen tried to impersonate so that it could be brought up as a human. So it's like a changeling. What a coincidence. And it, suddenly a SWAT team of some sort break in and attack Hellboy. And then we realize it's actually Ian McShane and his team. So these are his colleagues. So it's like, what? So it's just a ridiculous excuse to try and shoehorn some action in. And so then we're introduced to another character called Ben, who's Daniel Day-Kim, who is an agent working for Hellboy's dad, basically, that's going to help them out. So they go back to the Osiris Club and they find the pig boy who's taken the Blood Queen's arm that's there. Blood Queen turns up in some kind of spirit form and tries to explain to Hellboy what they're trying to do and he's special and all this stuff. And then, yeah, whatever, it doesn't work out. So then they go back to HQ, where Big Mo from EastEnders is running the outside of it. So EastEnders is a long-running, for those who don't know, a long-running British soap opera that's based in London, the East End of London, hence EastEnders. It's all very Cockney, whatever, and all this stuff. And it's known to be like a little bit more darker and serious than other ones. Anyway, Big Mo is a character. If you don't know, Big Mo is actually also Gary Oldman's sister. So she's in it, and it's just stupid. But whatever. So it's just so ridiculous. So, yeah, they go into the HQ, and they're having a bit of a catch-up. We see Ben has now gone to get some kind of special bullet to kill Hellboy with, which makes us automatically distrust him and not like the guy. It's such a weird scene to put in, and it doesn't really pay off that much later, apart from to have like a little mini ticking clock. It's weird. So Hellboy and his dad have an argument about how his dad was sent to kill him and all that stuff. They go over that. Hellboy is then transported to the witch from before. Don't really know why. And then we see some horrific things about eating children and all this stuff, which I thought was quite cool, actually, but clearly done for effect. And then Hellboy makes a deal about giving her his eye in exchange for the Blood Queen's location. So immediately after that, goes back on his deal when he finds out where she is, and a fight breaks out. And I quite like the witch's character. I like the way she looks. She's all super horrible and creepy, and the way she moves is quite disgusting. She's one of the better elements of the film, to be honest. So even though this scene is completely ridiculous and superfluous, I quite like how she looks and acts and her as a character, I suppose. But yeah, she's completely not needed. So she curses him to lose a loved one or whatever. And then he's sent back to HQ. So they go to this location, and for some reason, it's just the three of them. I don't know why they don't have more or sent back up. And the other two get waylaid by zombies. We find out that Ben Dendo Kim's character was like he's the sole survivor of some attack in a jungle by this beast when it's, that looks a bit like Predator, whatever. And you know, hey, guess what? He's the beast. We find that out later, and it's so fucking obvious. And he keeps taking these injections. It's like, right, okay. So yeah, that reveal is completely lame when it happens. So Hellboy's left by himself to go take on this Blood Queen, who's with this pig boy thing. And so the Blood Queen is now fully back together. She's at full health. She says she doesn't want to kill Hellboy. They're supposed to be together and rule as king and queen. Hellboy doesn't buy it, basically. And then Alice turns up shouting, Hellboy, or whatever, idiot. So Blood Queen throws some twig of her stupid crown and it hits this Alice in the neck. Hellboy rushes over. Oh my God, no, whatever. And she disappears. So they go, some random witch takes them to Merlin, basically Merlin's tomb. Merlin wakes up, cures Alice and tells Hellboy that he's actually the bloodline of King Arthur and is actually able to conjure up Excalibur in the stone for Hellboy to take it. But Hellboy gets visions of ruling a fiery London and doesn't take it up. So Merlin is like, you know, man, that was my last bit of power, you idiot. God's sake. And then he crumbles into dust. They go back to HQ and they see everyone's dead, basically, and Hellboy's dad's gone. They go to St. Paul's. I can't even remember how they know to go to St. Paul's, but they go there. And that's in London, by the way. It's the big church in London. And the Blood Queen's going around London and spewing out all this plague stuff and whatever. So they run into the pig boy, who's now become like super beef, and he's huge. And so they Ben becomes the beast thing, and they fight this guy. And the pig man is about to kill Hellboy, and Blood Queen is like, no, stop. And basically kills the pig guy. See ya. Hellboy finds himself in King Arthur's tomb, because he gets smashed through the floor, whatever, and Excalibur's there. It's convenient. So then his dad comes over and tries to dissuade him or whatever, and sits standing right next to Blood Queen. Like they're both like looking in. It's just so weird. And the Blood Queen just kills the dad. She goes, on his neck. It's like that and dies. And so in anger, Hellboy basically pulls the sword out and suddenly hell opens up and these rather the cool looking animals and creatures, I should say, sorry, that come up and just basically start killing folk, London people. Then Ben is about to pop a shot to kill Hellboy with his magic bullet, but Alice calls forth the dad from the dead in this weird, like, mouth ulcer way. And it's completely, like, CG. Oh, God, it's just so horrible, the CG here. And basically, this Ian McShane is essentially telling Hellboy to man up. So it's a continuation of this toxic masculinity. There's no, like, you know what, son, I've treated you harshly. Or maybe he does say this, but I didn't get the impression across. I've treated you harshly. I love you, you can do this, or whatever, and stuff like that. It's more like, come on, be a man. No, you don't have to give in to fate. Fate doesn't dictate you, and all this stuff. And it's supposed to be this, like, I don't know, enthusiastic, rip-roaring speech, or whatever, but it's, I don't know, just, I was just like, why is he being such a dick all the time? It just kept me annoyed. And Hellboy's like, I'm not ready. And he's like, yes, you are, you're ready, you can do this. But whatever. So, Hellboy kills the Blood Queen using Excalibur, I believe again as well, and throws her head into hell. And him and the dad have their little moment. We then cut to 6 months later, and Hellboy, Alice and Ben have this crappy fight in like a 90s music video, it looks like, where she basically, they basically just slaughter some scientists or something and find a tank, which we presume Abe is in. And that's it. That's the film. That's Hellboy 2019. It's awful. It's really bad. If it's really like, it's part of me which is like, if the hook, like what was it? What was the story they were telling here? Because it's interesting, the father and son dynamic of something like that. But the dad's a dick. He doesn't change. Hellboy doesn't really change either. No one changes. There's no lessons learned, really. Like, Hellboy hasn't learned how to become responsible or learning that he actually loves his father because he's just getting annoyed at him for nothing, really, apart from the fact that his dad's, you know, he's a bit of a dick. But the thing which seems to really get his goat is that he didn't tell him that he was there to kill him. And it's like, I kind of get that you might be like, but I'd be more like relieved. More like, oh, you know, what a good turn. Not get angry at him for it. What am I angry at him for? For not saying. It's like, why does it matter? Like, why? When's a good time to bring that up? Especially when, you know, someone like Helper kicks off all the time. I don't know. So that was weird. The other character, I'm like, I don't really even understand what's supposed to happen with the other characters. Like, what is, and the whole King Arthur, oh yeah, I can't remember if I said he's supposed to be King Arthur's bloodline or whatever. Like, Hellboy's mum was a human and had sex with the devil when they gave birth to Hellboy. Something like that. It's just, God, it's just so bad. It's really bad. It's just, it's boring. It's nonsensical. There's way too many characters. And yeah, it is gory, actually, but it's bad gore. And, you know, sometimes that was one of the things coming in. It's like, this Hellboy is going to be gory. And it's like, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be good, does it? And they say, oh, it's going to be darker. It's totally not darker, especially when you compare it to 2004 one, which we will do. That one is darker, literally, visually, and just all over. Like, this one is not dark. I mean, most of it does take place in the daylight. It's stupid. So, as I said before, the CG looks cheap. The acting is dire. It's really bad. Harbour actually does really hold the film together. And to be honest, Mila Jovovich does what she does best. She hams it up quite nicely. She doesn't take it too seriously, which is perfect, basically, for that. That's what you needed. Some of the monster creations are cool. It's a shame they weren't executed better, but okay. And, you know, it's a little tip for filmmakers out there. Set more of it in the dark if your CG looks shit. It's a very, very simple, it's very simple thing where if you have bright lights shining on your CG or whatever, it takes place in the daylight, you are going to make it look worse than if it was set in dark. Especially when it's something like Hellboy, which doesn't necessitate that it happens during the day. Anyway, story's a mess. Motivations and plot devices are just nonsense and inconsistent. There's just not that much enjoyable stuff going on. It's not funny. The action scenes are rare, and to be honest, they're not that great either. So it really does get very boring very quickly. Even though Hellboy creator Mike Mignola is his name, was originally involved, it was Andrew Consby who got the writing credit. And I think I actually had a chat with him a while ago with one of my old companies he used to work for. We were doing something with Boom Comics, Boom Studios, which he's the founder of, I believe. And yes, so that's quite interesting. Really nice guy. But yeah, I don't think he's done, I had a brief look into this. I don't think he's actually had a proper full-on feature writing credit, and it shows. Sorry to say. And apparently the production itself was messy. The studio apparently fired the original cinematographer that Marshall chose. And even though the official statement is that it was a group decision, rumours have still suggested that Marshall was unhappy with that decision, unsurprisingly. Apparently the producers, namely Lloyd Levin, would give actors different directions from Marshall during all processes of the shoot, actually, to be honest, apparently from castings to read-throughs to actual filming. Apparently Harper would walk off the set, which I don't like the idea of because I like Hopper and I like Harper, so I don't want to think that he's just like some, you know, dickhead actor. But who knows what happened. So him and McShane would apparently make up dialogue on the spot. The script is being constantly amended, which does happen, but apparently this was a noticeable difference. You know, whilst they were shooting, I should say. And since release, I believe it's made just over $40 million worldwide, and it had a budget of 50. So it will, like all these films, it will make it up at some point, but I think you can safely say that it's a flop. It got panned by the critics, as I said. Harbour was quite vocal about the fact that he tried his best. Jovovich thinks that it may receive cult status in the future due to her older films having the same effect, Resident Evil. And to be honest, I, with the first Resident Evil, it was bad, but I still weirdly enjoyed it, and it had a story. But this one is nothing like that. They can't compare it. Yeah, so that's the 2019 Hellboy. It's terrible, and it's dire. So now let's get on to the 2004 version of Hellboy.
Watch your hands and elbows.
Pardon?
Welcome to the Bureau for Paranormal Research and Defense. There are things that go bump in the night, Agent Myers. And we are the ones who bump back.
Hellboy.
So the 2004 version of Hellboy did really well, to be honest, and for good reason, and we'll go into why. It had Ron Perlman as Hellboy. You might know him from things of Sons of Anarchy. He's done a lot of stuff with Del Toro before in the past as well. John Hurt stars as the Professor. And Selma Blair stars as Liz. And Jeffrey Tambor is in it as well as the kind of head FBI honcho. I think his name's Tom Manning. Doug Jones, who people know, worked a lot with Del Toro as well. He's a very tall, skinny man. He does a lot of the prosthetic. He's in a lot of the prosthetic suits, and he's in, for instance, the new Star Trek series. He plays the alien captain. I can't remember his name in that. And there might be some other people that you recognise, but those are kind of the main pieces. So, yeah, it's released April the 6th, 2004. And Mike Mignola, who is the creator of Hellboy, said that he enjoyed it and he liked it. And it grossed $59.7 million, it says here, in North America alone, and $39.7 million in the rest of the world, and it had a budget of $66 million. So it did well, did really, really well for us, but for the first one. I believe Hellboy 2 did even better, but it was pretty good. It got good scores when it came out. The critics seemed to like it. The people seemed to like it. And since then, it's known as one of the better superhero movies, especially at a time before the whole Marvel thing kicked off. So what actually happens? So straight off the bat, you get a little bit of scripture, which talks about basically an apocalypse kind of coming. So already there's something epic kind of going on here, and the film hasn't even really started yet. The intro bit is narrated by John Hurt's character, who's the professor. Yeah, he kind of pulls you in as you go through this storm. I'm talking about, you know, there's big things happening, changing the course of history. And the fact that that night changed his life forever, all this stuff. And then we get into what looks like a war film. So it's really rainy. It's really dark. It looks great, especially compared to that god-awful scene in the latest one. This really feels like, you know, some soldiers getting ready to pounce on the castle. So already you're in, you kind of feel like I'm engaged with this is cool. You find out that the professor is like a pacifist and all this stuff. He's an intellectual, but he also believes in God. There's a there's a cross with Jesus on looking down at him. He's got these beads which play an important part later, so he's a religious man of science, which is helpful in this film. So what's good is that they kind of tell us a lot of what's going on here whilst they're moving. And I always call it like the kind of the Terminator effect, where like Carl Reese in that talks about the future and what's happening and all this stuff, and puts a lot of the context of the film whilst they're being chased. So it's not just people standing there talking about stuff. And if you compare it to like the Star Wars prequels, where it's the whole thing is constantly two people walking down a corridor or in a room with loads of special effects going on behind them, and they're just talking about exposition. And there's nothing happening. It's just them talking about stuff that you don't really care about. But with this one, you know, they're talking about it as they're kind of moving, and you're seeing things visually, and that makes sense. It's kind of to do what they're talking about. They're at these ruins in this Scottish castle. The Nazis have taken it over, and you see this assassin Nazi, I'm going to call him, who, you know, he's like just, he looks like a gimp essentially, but he's got his gas mask. It's all like PVC kind of thing. He's got his like long trench coat, his Nazi cap, and, you know, not saying Nazis are cool, but it's like, he's a very stylistic. He's a very, he kind of draws your attention. He's a visually arresting character. So I'm already in, and I'm like, who the hell is this bad guy? He looks fucking evil. It's great. So there's a brief moment between the Nazi woman and this mystic who we find out is Rasputin. And then he talks about her, serving him and that, you know, living forever, whatever, and all this stuff. So just in this one exchange, it's very quick. You get a lot of stuff in, and all of a sudden you're engaged in this weird, like, romance between these two characters you've not met or anything before, but you just feel that kind of passion comes over. And yeah, so anyway, they're kind of talking about how they're trying to engage this power that will, you know, destroy their enemies. And they've been working on it for 5 years, which is, you know, this is World War II now. So that's from the beginning of the war, maybe, depending on where this was. And so they open up this portal to another dimension. And there's these cool creatures kind of lurking and something. It's a light that kind of goes through the portal and it kind of knocks on the eye or whatever of this cool enemy. So it's much more grandiose already, immediately. And the action scenes as the good guys attack, they're cool. Like, and the assassin Nazi guy has these, like, knives in his arms and he's doing all this, like, cool ninja shit. And, yeah, meanwhile, the doctor guy... he's trying to slowly make his way to the grenade so he can throw it against the portal. And yeah, whilst it blows up, the assassin guy can't get there in time. He's impaled on the side. Looks like he might have died. Rasputin's dragged into this portal. And then they look and the assassin guy's just disappeared. Ooh, where's he gone? And then they talk about, you know, where's this portal going to? And then it's like, you know, it was hell, basically. But he doesn't, he's saying... there are things like hell. So he's just saying it's like an evil dimension that would be known as hell, which is kind of cool, like scientific slash religious kind of way of looking at it, which kind of ticks both boxes. So.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
They find Hellboy, who's like this little baby. And at that moment in time, you kind of understand why they're looking after it, because it's super cute. And... you know, it doesn't look like it's threatening or anything like that. And he's like this pacifist. He's already explained that. So it makes sense that he takes Hellboy in and all this stuff. And because he's a scientist as well. So that's already an explanation, really, for all that stuff that's happened. And this could be a short. That could have been a little short film in itself. And I'd have been interested in it. So already we've got this great, strong intro, which is really visually exciting. We've had all the plot points kind of ticked. We know what's going on. And then we have the title sequence, which the background looks a bit ropey. It looks like something from Doom or something like that. I don't know. It's like made on Windows 95. But you get these news clippings as time is passing of Hellboy scene here. And you get like audio things and all this stuff. So it's kind of to tell you about the world that we're in. And it's just to really quickly kind of get you up to speed with the now, that what's happened in between... the scene we just had in the present. And that's really good. So then we see we're in Moldavia. And it's all like snowy. And that's another good thing about this film is there's loads of different locations and all this stuff. So it feels a bit like an Indiana Jones movie at times where they're kind of skipping around the globe. It's quite cool. You see the Nazi woman and the assassin guy and they kill their guide essentially. And his blood comes in and then a bit like Hellraiser, Rasputin just kind of rises up. And then we cut to the doctor, who's now old. He's told he hasn't got long to live. And he's got these like tarot cards. It's all about second opinion. And he does a tarot card and it's a death card. And it's like, you know, that is his second opinion, essentially. So you can tell he's still kind of with the mystic arts, even though he's still slightly religious or whatever and all this, which is quite interesting. You see Jeffrey Tambor, who I forgot was in this. He's the head of special ops or whatever. And it's weird, it's on his talk show. Does that, is that a thing that happens in America? I don't know. Do you get head of departments, the FBI, in talk shows? I'm not sure. But yeah, he's a great kind of comedy actor. And well, you know, he's had a lot of scandals around him recently. But, you know, when I think about the work he's done, I have found him funny. And so that's, you know, as much as I'm going to say about that. So yeah, he's kind of a bit of the comic relief as such for the film. And a bit of a foil for like the internal kind of, arguments that kind of happen within this, bureau. So this new guy, John Myers, I think his name is, turns up and there's all this kind of modern looking equipment. There's a big hall, a bit like Men in Black style. He's taken down. And everything is big. It's full of wonder and excitement. You don't know what's going to happen next. It's all big sets. It looks cool. It's like super detailed. And you know, you could tell it's like from a director that cares about what he's actually making. You meet Abe, this super smart, knowledgeable, fish creature. And you know, you meet the doctor and he says about, you know, in the absence of light, dark prevails. There are things that go bump in the night. We're the ones that bump back. What a great little way of summing up exactly everything they do without going to town about it. So he kind of gives him a brief synopsis of how it started up. The fact that Hitler was involved with the occult. So they set up this bureau, basically. And so they kind of try and put it a little bit in like the real world history. It's quite interesting. And then they see this big safe. Inside is Hellboy. And, you know, they're looking at the comics. It's like, oh, I hate those comic books. You never get the eyes right. Which I thought was quite funny because it's like this element of like CG and Uncanny Valley or whatever and all this stuff. It's almost like, you know, knocking CG because there's a lot of practical effects that kind of go on here. And yeah, so you see him lifting weights. You hear about him breaking out to go see her. I mean, you see this woman on the screen. So that's Liz. It's a bit creepy, but it's to establish a history that there's more than what you're seeing. There's more bigger world here that you're kind of enveloped in. And it's also a plot point, so it kind of works on two levels. And I like the way it's kind of, you know, like red and blue. There's a lot of reds and blues. It's a very colourful film, which, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, like, took that to the extreme, for instance. And I think that colour in film sometimes gets a bit lost. So, like, you know, the reason why I bring up Guardians of the Galaxy is because people often say, like, X-Men was one of the greatest superhero films of all the time. Like, why can they do more with it like they did with Marvel? But the thing with Marvel is that Marvel went full into like the comics in a sense of they went with the costumes, they went with the bright colours, whereas DC and essentially, you know, Fox really never really did that. And that's something they missed out on because essentially they weren't being faithful to the comics or the comic crowd and why it engages people. So that's why I like this. And over the 2019 is one as well, because that looks quite bland. So there's not that much colour. Whereas this one, there's bright colours. If you feel something, it feels like it's jumping off the screen at you. So there's, they kind of meet and there's a straight away, there's a call for them to get into action. You, on the way there, you see Abe and Hellboy bickering, which is cool. Because it kind of shows that their relationship, that they're familiar. She says about her, you know, it says about Liz leaving him and all this stuff. And they talk about, he talks about being trapped. Hellboy, this is. So obviously he's got a bit of a, he's got a bit of a problem at the moment. Hellboy's very sarcastic. I really like his humor. And I think it's much funnier than the 2019 film. It's just a better script. And I think it was Guillermo del Toro that wrote it as well. And you can really see that. So this big ugly creature turns up. Abe talks about, you know, that it's a creature that resurrects or whatever. It's like kind of giving him intel, the Chloe in this situation, if this was 24. And then, yeah, fight the creatures. There's a lot of practical stuff here. There are bits of CG, but because it's dark and the way they use it, it's done really super well, much better than it's done in the 2019 release. We see Rasputin briefly. He says hello. And then, yeah, the human, the new guy, John, saves Hellboy, by shooting the monster's tongue thing. And, you know, so we kind of started to like him because he's brave and all this stuff, fearless. Creature runs off. There's a chase scene. And there's lots of kind of comedy bits in this as well. Like he keeps getting hit by the train as he's laying down. The train driver gets praised by all the people in the train because he hit Hellboy in the head. All this stuff is quite funny. You know, he kills the ugly creature thing. And there's two small souls that kind of separate. Like, oh, right, okay, wow. So Rasputin now has eyes. I don't really understand the eye thing. I don't know where that came from or whether that's the thing, but he's got these eyes back. He gets the two monsters now, gets their souls and makes them physically appear. And they talk about there's only like 7 days until the eclipse or something. So we've got like a ticking clock. We see a young couple kissing and he's got booze. Basically, Hellboy steals that, goes to see Liz. And that's just kind of trying to reflect the fact that he wants like this normal relationship with Liz, which he just basically hasn't got. Yeah, and it's quite sweet in its own way. So they have a little chat. Jeffrey Tambor turns up, says, you know, it's kind of like Billy Big Shot. He's got a cigar. He's kind of like this weird version of Hellboy in that he's, you know, the nasty, selfish kind of, you know, I'm in charge, I get really angry and all this stuff. So later on when they kind of become friends, that's kind of him making peace with his angry side, if that makes sense. And I might be reading too much into that, but that's kind of how I felt by the end of it. Anyway, that happens later. So we see Abe show the doctor what happened in this flashback scene, and you see the assassin ninja, and he's like winding himself up now. It's kind of this cool like clockwork thing. It takes loads of bullets, and he kills everyone, basically. Whilst all this is happening, you see them steal the what's it. Abe finds out that the doctor's sick, so I can't tell Hellboy. Liz tells Hellboy that, you know, whilst they're in this chat, that she's starting to control power. And if he really loves her, she'll just leave him alone. So he's a bit like conflicted. So he wants to see her, but he kind of understands. So again, it's about kind of this coming of age, almost like learning to be responsible and respect other feelings that maybe you're not in control. It's interesting. So they come to get Hellboy and the new guy, John, gives Liz a little look. They share a look and the doctor actually notices this look, which doesn't really come into play later, but it's just to show that it's like, although it's interesting because it's like, oh, do they like each other? And then you see the doctor looking and you think, well, he thinks like that. He's thinking the same as I am. So it kind of reconfirms this inkling that you had. So even though the doctor doesn't say or do anything about it later, he's there like you are because he's witnessed it as well. So it's just to kind of, you know, underline the fact that there was a little moment. There's a little moment there. They find out that this creature's latched onto Hellboy for like 5 seconds. In that time, it laid like 3 eggs. And he says something like, didn't even buy me a drink. It's funny. I like that line. It's good. We get a little bit more context on Liz as John looks up about her files and all this stuff and kind of looks into it a bit. Meanwhile, she gets paid a visit in her hospital thing by Rasputin, who makes her burst into flames and basically kill people, essentially. And there's all these trees with plastic bags on the outside. It's weird. I don't know why they do that. That must be a gardening thing. John turns up and he's like, oh, I think I can get her to come back. You know, I think I can do it. Hellboy's a bit like, shut up. Like, who the hell are you? You've just come in here, whatever. Gets really annoyed with him. So that John's like, says to the doctor, I don't think I should be here. Like, he doesn't like me. And the doctor's like, I'm going to die. Okay. I'm going to die. And I need someone with him that's like pure of heart. Like there's age old stories about young knights, pure of heart and all this stuff. And I think you're it. And he's like, well, I'm not whatever. And they're like, yeah, you are. You're like a good guy. You've got to teach him how to be a man. And I'm a bit like, well, he's like younger than him. Like, you know, okay. So, I don't know. So that was a bit strange. And also it's like, pure of heart, but yeah, he's kind of flirting with the guy's girlfriend, isn't he? I don't really understand that bit that much, but okay, right, I get it. He's supposed to be like the young classic hero in this thing that Hellboy has to learn to be. Fine. John Guy talks to Liz and she's like, oh, I always come back, I always go away and I come back. So we get the sense that, yeah, she's going to come back. We then see as Hellboy and Abe are making their way through the subway and trying to look for these eggs or whatever, We see the Nazi assassin. We see his like fucking scary, horrible eyes under his mask as he's kind of hearing people coming. And yeah, Hellboy gives Abe some kind of charm. He's like, oh, the monster's down there, should leave you alone. What's she got this on? She's like, okay, great. He goes down under the water and he's looking at his eggs. He's picking up all these eggs. And then he drops the charm and he gets attacked. So anyway, there's this little like cool underwater chase scene. It's very green and it feels like you're underwater like as well. It's not just like absolutely clear. It's really murky and green and horrible. And I really like that. And also it works for the CG side of it as well. So anyway, Hellboy fights this monster in the subway, kills him. The ninja assassin kills the security guard and then acts as if he's dead. So when Hellboy gets back, it's like, oh, quick, you know, you've got to take them all back to HQ or whatever. Liz and John make their way back to HQ and they have this like nice little moment where they're taking photos of each other, whatever, and all this stuff. Oh, how lovely. Are they falling in love? We're not sure. Is there going to be a love triangle? Maybe. So Abe seems to be okay. Jeffrey Tambor is quite dismissive of Hellboy. He winds him up a little bit. Hellboy gets angry and basically throws this thing out the window and everyone sees it and everyone's annoyed at him. Because he's like, typical Hellboy. He's always angry. Can't believe it. Then you kind of see the downtime, which I quite like. They give these moments of like reflection within the characters where they're like having this chat during their downtime. But yeah, it cuts to the ninja assassin who's on the table getting looked at, and they're poking around him. The professor is and saying like, his blood's made of dust and he was addicted to surgery and he runs on clockwork essentially, and he just looks all fucked up. He's got no lips, no eyelids, whatever. It's really fucking cool. And it's like horrific, to be honest. That's what I really like about Del Toro, is he's never afraid to kind of board on that horror, which same as Hellboy really in terms of the comics and stuff as well, I believe. So yeah, meanwhile John and Liz go get some coffee at night. Hellboy goes out, follows them, super envious, and she's like taking pictures of him, and Hellboy's getting really annoyed, like, oh, she takes a picture, you take a picture, can't believe it, and all this stuff, which you kind of get. It's like that's a bit weird. And also because he's obviously very aware of how he looks. So this guy's like a dashing young man who's not like this big red monster. So, you know, I imagine that's even why it's such a thing for him as well. The assassin wakes up, comes down. Rasputin is now there. The professor is like, oh, shit, I'm going to die, aren't I? And yeah, Rasputin shows the professor like this apocalyptic wasteland with Hellboy at the top with his crown. And it's like, this is the future, this is what's going to happen, whatever. And they talk about, you know, he's going to open the portal and all this stuff. And the doctor's like, nope, he's my son. I don't care what other people call him. You know, he's my boy kind of thing. He's my boy. Anyway, they kill him. So he's dead. And they kind of allow time to kind of happen here. So they reflect on it. So there's a funeral for the doctor. It's all very dramatic. Hellboy's obviously really upset, but they kind of just have these little kind of montage sequences, these little vignettes, rather than like a whole thing of like, I'm angry or like anything like that. And it's quite nice. So now we're in Russia. Rasputin has this stone to open up this portal. Hellboy and their team follow. Basically, they go there as well. They go to this graveyard. And Hellboy has this mystical thing. He gets this skeleton that basically puts on his back, who again is some kind of comic relief. It's just funny. It's just weird, all these things. It's great. They go into a tomb, and it's basically a trap. It's like a Tomb Raider slash Indiana Jones type thing. So Jeffrey Tambor is kind of like the bad dad. As I said, it might be a representation of Hellboy's kind of childishness, maybe. But he's just very angry. He's kind of pushing authority. Like, no, you do this, you do that. And there's this cool scene with a swinging hammer taking out this bridge. But they get across, you know, Hellboy saves him, whatever, and, you know, plays the good guy. And there's a cool bit where, like, Indiana Jones kind of getting his hat at the last second as his door closes. Hellboy whips in his tail, which is quite cool. So they see the Nazi assassin guy again. Jeffrey Tambor almost gets killed. And then both him and Hellboy almost fall into this trap with spikes to the bottom. Tambor climbs out and he helps kill the Nazi guy by throwing cogs at him or whatever. And yeah, they look down and they have this like bonding moment over a cigar, which is quite nice. So they've kind of resolved their issues as such. Liz and John come across loads of those monster things that, you know, we saw earlier. Hellboy smashes his way down to come help save them. Liz tells John to hit her. to get her angry, and she does, and she basically goes flame on. Anyway, she bursts out with all this fire and whatever. They wake up, Rasputin's tied them all up, sucks the soul or something from Liz. Hellboy becomes all like ragey. He gets out of this thing that he's trapped in. His horns come, there's suddenly a fiery crown, and he opens, there's like two places to put his hands, so he opens the portal, half of the portal, and this huge monster starts to like come down. And then the new guy, John, has the beads that the professor had. He's like, remember who you are. And he throws the beads to Hellboy before he unlocks the final lock. And it burns a cross in Hellboy's hand, which I thought was quite cool. Because in a weird way, it's to show that inherently he's evil because it's like it's burnt a cross in his hand. But he's looking at it because, you know, he's thinking of his dad and how much he adores him and stuff. So it's really cool the way that it's literally a physical representation of how he's kind of moved away. He's consciously decided to go away from his, what he's supposed to be. He's this monster or something like that, to be more than that. And even though that thing in his hand hurt him, he doesn't look at it because it hurts. He looks at it because it reminds him of his dad. And that's the humanity winning over his innate, natural fate as such, which is kind of the whole point, right? So he remembers his dad. And yeah, it's quite a touching little moment, which in any other film is usually the sign of like, you know, like Exorcist or something, pushing the cross up and it burns and all this stuff. And in a really cool way, it's used to something quite loving, which is great when, you know, when you think about it. So Rasputin starts ordering Hellboy to open it. And obviously we realise Hellboy doesn't really like being talked to like that, which is quite funny. So he breaks his horns off. He kills Rasputin with one of his horns, which is pretty cool. The portal closes up. That monster kind of disappears. And then, weirdly, this like thing from the end of Prometheus, if anyone remember, comes out of Rasputin and just starts growing. The Nazi woman comes over, she starts kissing him, oh, my love, whatever. And then they both seem to be killed. Hellboy makes sure Liz and John are safe. She's like, oh, you know, look after her, get her back there, whatever. Don't worry about me. And then the monster pulls him back for this kind of like epic fight against this huge creature. And what's kind of key with this is it doesn't last too long. It doesn't need to. And the CG here doesn't look too bad. It's still of its time, but compared to the Hellboy 2019, which looks worse, then I think, you know, it's 15 years old now, and that's, I still think that looks pretty good. Anyway, he kind of gets swallowed, so he gets kind of sacrificed as such. The belly of the beast, the grenades sets them off, blows them up. So yeah, it's a really quick final battle. And it could be to a point where I was a bit like that. It felt like it ended quite quickly, but it was a long film. It was 2 hours 12. So, you know, not surprised. And it ends with him and Liz kissing and kind of John looking on. He's kind of fine with it because they never really, you know, they kind of explore a little bit earlier because he's like, you know, you don't like me like that, do you? And she's like, oh my God, men are all the same. So there's no like actual talk about whether they did like each other. And it's like, well, maybe this might happen in a future thing. It doesn't. But I liked that just, even though it kind of didn't go anywhere, it was never really supposed to. And yeah, I just quite enjoyed that aspect of it. But there was something that made me think this guy's a little bit creepy, but fine. So yeah, it's got, it's a lot of like location variety in there. I think it's just a much better film. It's much better produced. It's just cooler, to be honest. And I think the directing is great. Visually, it works really well. You can tell a lot of time and effort and energy went into it. And that's, you know, what you get with someone like Del Toro. As compared, and sorry to say, like Neil Marshall, as much as he can blame the studio for it and say like, oh, it's studio's fault. And maybe he's not officially said that, but still, that's what the rumours are. There's an element where it's like, well, don't do it then. You know, like, if you're, there are directors, there are auteurs and there are directors for hire. And you can be either. You can be either. But don't get upset when you want to be an auteur when you know you're being used as a director for hire. And that sounds like a really dick thing to say, doesn't it? Because, you know, there are people out there who, every auteur is still a director for hire. And I realise that, but there's an element where it's like, you know, you get like David Lynch, who decided not to do the latest Twin Peaks, almost, because he was like, well, you haven't got the budget to do the way I want to do it, so I'm not going to do it. And that's, you know, that's putting your art over what you're getting paid. And there's nothing wrong with not going down that route and being like, I want to get paid to get this film done. But if it's not going to your liking, or if you felt like it could have been better, or could have done with more time and more money, then yeah, you should have said that, or maybe done something about it, or just said, this isn't right for me, it's not going to work out. And sometimes there's a thing is, you know, cutting your losses. And I'm not saying he's done that or anything like that, but if it's true that like during the casting process, people start to stick their oar in already, then that's why loads of directors turn up their backs on films for whatever reason. So there's only so much sympathy you can have for something like that. And especially since it's like, oh, if it was like a big success, you know, he wouldn't be moaning about it then, would he? If it was, you know, done really well. And also there's that element, like it happens with Netflix as well, where directors, I'm kind of going off on one now, but where directors are saying they want creative freedom. And, you know, if only I was allowed to do what I want, but the studios got involved and they wanted to do this and that and this. And you always hear the bad stories about that, but you never hear the good ones, do you? And the reason for that is that because it will be the directors or whomever moaning that they didn't get the way they wanted to do it. So you always think, well, it would have been better. It would have been better. And there are some instances where it's like, that's probably true. Alien 3 or something like that with David Fincher probably would have been a much better movie if he'd just been allowed to do what he wanted. And he was very vocal about the fact that he fucking hated that, making that movie. But then, you know, you get cases where you think, well, that's why a studio's there. That's why you have studio teams there, because they're more experienced and they help make these films great. I mean, it's kind of like what Marvel do a bit, maybe. I'm not sure, because I can't really say, obviously, from firsthand. But, you know, they're very much, they know what they want and how they want it. And there's a consistency, even though there's different directors, there's a consistency between all those films. They do have their own visual, certain style and flair or whatever, and all this stuff that directors bring to it, obviously. But end of the day, sometimes a studio is right. And things like Netflix, where it says complete creative control, it's like, that's not a good thing. That's not always a good thing. It's about team effort. And you have things like Duncan Jones's film that he did for Netflix, which I can't remember, about the deaf guy, in the future. And that was terrible. It was awful. And that's because he had free reign to do what he wanted. And like, here's the money. Just go make what you want. There was no one to reel him in at all. It's what they said about George Lucas with, like, everything. But no, with like, well, Return of the Jedi as well, but also with the prequels and stuff, because he didn't have his producers there. They were just all sycophants saying yes, yes, yes to everything. It's George Lucas, of course you're going to say yes. When it's like, well, no, you don't have to. He's not necessarily right all the time. But yeah, anyway, going off on one now. So Hellboy 2019 versus Hellboy 2004. The clear winner is Hellboy 2004 by Del Toro. Now, I'd be interested in what you guys think. Maybe if I'm wrong, maybe the new Hellboy wasn't that bad. Maybe there were some theories or some bits in it that I missed that have a bigger meaning, a greater meaning that I probably didn't touch upon. And yeah, I'd just be interested to hear what everyone else thought of it. And I'm all up for hearing about why I'm wrong. Because I get that at home as well. So you can follow us on at A New Winter on Twitter and Instagram. Email us if you want, anewwinterpodcast@gmail.com. I would also love it if you could just please go to Patreon and go to patreon.com/anewwinter. And we've got some tiers, different tiers for different things that you can kind of subscribe into, give you content and things like that. So we really want to start building that up because, yeah, at the moment, we're doing this for free, which is fine. And if you can review us on your podcast platform of choice, that would also be great. But we'd really love it if you could just make a small donation. The smallest one is $3. For $5, you get access to our exclusive feed, where I'll be doing lots more stuff. And if I make it to $250 a month, which would be lovely, then I'll be able to do a series on Twin Peaks and go through each episode one by one. Which it will be great fun for everybody. Anyway, thanks very much for listening to this, guys, and I will see you in hell, boy.
Why do you fight for those who hate and fear you? You were meant for this. Out of the ashes, new Eden will emerge.
Okay, I'd appreciate a prophecy with more relatable stakes.
Haven't we got to be saving the world or something?
Yeah, okay, come on. Let's get your game face on. Yeah, come on, let's do this.
You know, because I'm a Capricorn and you're fucking nuts!
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.